happy to be in your midst, you know, this afternoon. And what I simply want to do is threefold. I'll, you know, go ahead and you know, tell you a little about you know, the Awareness League in Nigeria. You know, then I would attempt to, you know, do a summary of this book, you know, which I am a co-author. And then finally, I'll go into, you know, discussing in detail, you know, some of the problems and difficulties, you know, we have on the African continent, and maybe also talk about, you know, the specific problems we have in Nigeria. Then after that, if there are questions or maybe comments, I could also take, you know, from everybody. Let me begin by, you know, saying a few things about the Awareness League in Nigeria. The Awareness League is an anarcho-syndicalist, you know, organization in Nigeria. A member of the IWA, you know, which is the Anarcho-Syndicalist International. The Awareness League became an anarchist, transformed into an anarchist group in 1990. Before then, it started actually as a Marxist-Leninist group, you know, in the early 80s. You know, but following the convulsions in Eastern Europe and eventual collapse of communism, you know, the members of the Awareness League, you know, started you know, thinking ahead about what next, you know, to do. And it was in the process, you know, that the Awareness League transformed into an anarchist group in 1990. In 1996, it was admitted into the IWA, as I said, and before then, you know, we had commenced work on this book, and eventually it came out last year. The Awareness League is essentially a social movement, an alternative trade union, because in different parts of Africa and Nigeria especially, you know, there is widespread disillusionment and frustration, you know, with the official labor unions. These official labor unions, you know, do not fight for the welfare and interests of their members anymore. You know, they do not even as much as articulate their problems and needs. The leadership of most of these unions are easily compromised by the government. You know, so in the face of the disillusionment of the working class in most of African states, you know, with the official unions, you know, there is a new impetus, you know, to develop alternative platforms, you know, for workers, you know, to be able to organize, agitate, and fight for their rights and interests. Most of the official labor unions actually government are no better than government parastatals, in the sense that the government collects, you know, the check-off dues for them and actually supplements, you know, their budget for the most part. And most of the time, the leaders owe, you know, their position and tenor to the government. What we do essentially in the Awareness League is twofold. You know, first and foremost, we do a lot of political education and enlightenment, you know, trying to create the necessary awareness, you know, because anarchism, you know, as a social movement, as a social philosophy, is still a very recent thing to several parts of Africa. You know, so we carry out study groups, we do workshops, and we hold lectures. We have a quarterly newsletter, you know, which we publish among ourselves and circulate, and also give out to non-members as well. Then The second thing we do is we do campaigns. You know, we carry out protests, we agitate and try to mobilize the, you know, workers, you know, to be able to protest their rights, to be able to fight against increased exploitation, you know, by multinational corporations, you know, by government, and by employers of labor generally. There is a unique phenomenon in Nigeria and most parts of Africa, you know, whereby workers go for months on end without being paid their salaries. And in the face of the seeming alliance between worker, the leadership of most of the official unions and the government, you know, they cannot actually fight, you know, for the payment of these worker salaries. We've, you know, had occasions to organize and mobilize the workers to embark on strikes. In 1993 and 1994 in Nigeria, there was a general oil worker strike, you know, that virtually paralyzed the country and brought the economy to its knees. You know, we're very, very much a part of it. You know, one of the ways in which we, you know, carry out our campaigns and the agitations is, of course, to link up hands with other, you know, left-leaning organizations and anti-authoritarian platforms, you know, in different parts of the country. Once we identify a common ground, you know, for our struggle, we join them and, you know, carry out the protests and agitation. And when it is all over, we all, of course, return to our separate identities. That, in a summary, is the kind of things, you know, the Awareness League is involved in. Let me just say that there are many more things would have loved to, you know, be able to do, you know, but which we are not currently doing because we are constrained in several ways. You know, one of them is, you know, trying to get more women, you know, to be able to, I mean, to join our group and to be very active in, you know, left anti-authoritarian groups. We've not had much success in this regard. You know, part of the reason is cultural. Many women in different parts of Africa, even though they do a bulk of the work, you know, and, you know, still get to perform their role as mothers, they don't exactly see themselves as being workers, you know. So it is always a very big problem, you know, trying to mobilize women, you know, to be able to do this kind of activist undertakings. The other area would have loved to really be able to do much is in the area of the fight against AIDS, you know, which is a very, you know, serious problem on the African continent today. We've not been able to do much, you know, because we do not, you know, have the resources, you know, to do the necessary enlightenment and also to, you know, be able to dispense maybe condoms and to really go, you know, in the hinterland and be able to do this. You know, but we do hope, you know, that as our organization continues to grow and develop, we'll be able to do that. You know, this, in a summary, is, you know, what we do in the Awareness League. I shall then go ahead to give a summary of the central theme of this book, you know, which we did. We started this book by pointing out the fact that anarchism as a social movement and a social philosophy, you know, is still almost unknown, you know, to different parts of Africa. It's unknown in the theoretical realm, you know, because there's not been a lot of academic or intellectual work, you know, done, you know, by Africans on the concept of anarchism. You know, besides, we've not really had, you know, big anarchist movements in different parts of Africa. You know, the only exception would appear to be South Africa, you know, where we've always had a strong anarchist current, you know, since about 1910, when the IWW was formed in South Africa, and they were very much active, you know, in the struggle, you know, against in the struggle for workers' rights and the workers' emancipation, up to the time when South Africa was transformed into an apartheid state. Interestingly, the IWW in South Africa was actually a predominantly white movement, although, you know, you had a couple of black South Africans who were also members. You know, that's South Africa represents, you know, the nearest example, you know, of the only place in Africa, you know, where you had a strong anarchist tradition. Of course, there was a lot of anarchist influence, you know, on the Algerian Revolution. If you go through the writings of Frantz Fanon, you know, who actually inspired and influenced the revolution a lot, he was, in many cases, espousing clearly very anarchist ideas in his writings. Today, a couple of anarchist movements are beginning to come up in different parts of Africa. There are about two or three in South Africa. You know, there's one in Nigeria. There are small groups in Zimbabwe and Zambia, and there is a branch of IWW in Sierra Leone. You know, this is as far as, you know, we can say that anarchism is beginning to really, you know, gain some foothold on the African continent. You know, but what we essentially set out to do in this book is to look at, you know, the practical proposals of anarchism and do further investigation of the traditional African society and be able to draw similarities, you know, between the proposals of anarchism and the traditional African society. The traditional African society was organized along the lines of, you know, what you could call African communalism. That was the basis of social organization of the traditional African society. And within this African communalism, you know, the villages, you know, were the units of organization. You know, you had a multiplicity of villages, you know, that were to a large extent independent and autonomous of each other, and they jealously guarded their self-identity. You know, I shall, you know, fully explain what African communalism means and how it operates, you know, by reference to, you know, three related issues. First and foremost, I am going to talk about, you know, the extended family system in the traditional African society. I'm going to talk about the decision-making process in a typical African village. I'm also going to talk about the land tenure system or the land ownership system in a traditional African society. When I talk about a traditional African society, I am referring to, you know, that society that existed, you know, prior to the coming of colonialism, prior to the coming of capitalism, and prior to the establishment of the state system in Africa. To a large extent, this traditional African society still subsists and exists today, but especially it exists in the non-urban areas. You know, in the urban areas, there are still features and elements of the traditional African society, you know, but it is constantly, you know, being swallowed up, you know, by trends of modernism and Western ideas and values and ethos. If we look at the extended family system in Africa, you know, what we call the extended family is in direct contrast to the nuclear family system or setup in the West. You know, what we call the extended family in Africa is actually a group of people, maybe numbering in their tens or hundreds, you know, who trace their ancestry, you know, to a common ancestor. In other words, all the people, you know, who make up the extended family can actually trace their genealogy, you know, up to a common ancestor and say, we are the descendants of the forebears of so-so and so. Now that is what we call the extended family in Africa. As I said, the membership could number in tens or hundreds, as the case may be. And to underline, you know, the strength of the extended family system in Africa, in most African languages, you cannot find the equivalent of such words as cousin, uncle, nephew, aunt, you know, such as you have in the West. You know, in Africa, everybody is either your brother or your sister, such that if you maybe happen to visit Africa, you know, any of these days, and you know, maybe your host, you know, begins to introduce a whole lot of people to you as my brother, my sister, you know, you should not begin to wonder, you know, how it is that he has so many brothers or so many sisters. He's actually telling you that this person is a member of my extended family. The person could actually be first cousin, second cousin, or even third cousin, you know, but everybody sees himself either as your brother or your sister. The strength of the extended family, you know, is so strong. I mean, it's such that every member of the extended family, you know, owes allegiance, you know, first and foremost, you know, to that extended family. You know, you see yourself as a member of that extended family, and not necessarily as a member of your own immediate, maybe nuclear, the kind of thing you call nuclear family here. If there's going to be a marriage, you know, between a member of that extended extended family and maybe another extended family, it is always the case that the whole transaction, you know, is done between the two extended families. It's not just between the parents of the partners, because again, in Africa, marriage is seen, you know, not as a contract. You know, it is seen more as a social responsibility and the union of, you know, two extended families. And if along the line conflicts or disagreements, you know, occur, it is both extended families that will be called upon, you know, to mediate and settle, you know, such disputes. You know, that's in a nutshell is how the extended family works. I shall return to this subject, you know, when I go into the, you know, land ownership structure in Africa. Let me talk now about the decision-making process, you know, in a typical African village. Before the coming of colonialism and capitalism, you know, several African societies, traditional societies, had actually developed, you know, what many writers, you know, call, you know, village-based democracies. When I talk about village-based democracies, how it works is that every village, as I said, is independent, feels autonomous of each other. You know, even where you have a multiplicity of villages, you know, every village is autonomous, independent, and manages its own activities, you know, on its own. So, if an issue arises in a village, now, what usually happens is that the chief priest, you know, who is the custodian of, you know, several sacred instruments, you know, of the village, normally summons one of the people we call town criers, you know, and hands over the gong, a big gong of the village, you know, to him. And with the gong, the town crier goes around the village, you know, to summon everybody to the village square, maybe for the following day. And it is actually at the village square that the agenda, you know, for the meeting, you know, is stated. You know, the people who usually preside, you know, at such meetings are the oldest people in the village. You know, in the African traditional society, you know, age was equated with wisdom. You know, so it was felt that the old people, you know, we are wise people and could actually effectively lead the village and not lead the village astray. So it was the elders in that village, in that particular village, that presided over such assembly meetings. Their role in this context is essentially to guide the village, you know, towards achieving consensus. You know, the basic aspiration, you know, of the village in this regard was always to be able to arrive at a consensus. And if, for one reason or the other, maybe there are disagreements among different extended families, you know, such that the gathering could not, you know, achieve a consensus on the basic issues presented before it, you know, what usually happens is that the elders, you know, using their own initiative, you know, would adjourn, you know, such a meeting, and I mean to a later date, you know, during which, you know, wider consultations would have taken place among the various extended families, you know, to be able to achieve a consensus. So, by and large, you know, consensus was the key thing, was the key issue in this village-based type of democracy. And the African society, traditional society, had actually developed a number of institutions, you know, which not only held these societies together, you know, but also enforced sanctions, you know, maybe which the village might have placed on some people or some groups. One of these institutions is known as the Masquerade Society. You know the masquerade that puts on mask, and whenever the village are taking a decision on certain things, maybe impose sanctions on some people, it was the duty and responsibility of the Masquerade Societies, you know, to enforce this. And the Masquerade Societies, in enforcing this, they are seen as the agents of the ancestors, you know, such that the offender or the person that might have been sanctioned, you know, often does not resist, you know, because resistance means assaulting the masquerade, you know, which is actually seen as the spirit of the ancestors. You know, then we had what we call the age sets or the age grade system in several traditional African societies, whereby, you know, people born within different age groups, I mean age brackets, you know, came together and formed an age set and performed one function or the other in society. Maybe the very young ones could be the ones who sweep the village square or the path to the stream, and this cut across both men and women. It was the very young, you know, age groups that constituted the labor reserve or the labor force of the village. You know, it was, you know, this very group that, you know, people approached, you know, to be able to engage in farm work, you know, build houses, grade the paths, and all what have you. This was how the traditional, you know, African village-based democracies worked and made decisions, you know, and to a great extent, you know, the traditional society, you know, except for those societies that had actually gotten to the point of feudalism before the coming of colonialism and capitalism, you know, to a great extent, the decision-making process was egalitarian and open, and every person, you know, within the village context, you know, felt a part of this decision-making process. Finally, I'll talk about the land ownership structure, you know, in the typical traditional African society. Essentially, there were two types of land in the traditional society. You know, first and foremost, we have the communal land. You know, the communal land refers to large tracts of land, you know, usually meant for farming purposes, and which belong to the entire village in common. They could also include the sacred groves or the sacred forests, you know, which was owned in common, you know, among the village. And every adult male member of that village, you know, could lay equal claim, you know, to the land. And under no circumstances, you know, was could anybody, any single individual or group, actually alienate, you know, this communal land, because it was handed over to the village, you know, by their ancestors. You know, the second type of land is known as a family land. This is a land that belonged to the extended family, and every adult male within the extended family, you know, had equal claim, you know, to that land. It could actually be for farming purposes or for other purposes. And again, like in the communal land, this is a land, you know, that was bequeathed to the extended family by their common ancestor, and nobody, you know, among the extended family, you know, had any right to alienate any portion of the land, because they held this land, you know, in trust, you know, for future and successive generations. The central element in the land tenure system, you know, within the traditional society, emphasized user rights over land as against ownership rights. You know, it was still possible, you know, for anybody who wanted, you know, a portion of land, maybe for building houses, you know, to approach the extended family and be given a portion of land. You know, and after you might have built your house, this land, technically and constructively, does not really belong to you. It still belongs to the extended family, you know, in the sense that if, for instance, you know, the individual dies and maybe had no issue, the land automatically reverted back, you know, to the extended family, you know. So this is essentially how the communal, you know, traditional African society, you know, dealt with land. And even up to today in the villages, it is unheard of, you know, for anybody, you know, to seek to alienate any land. You know, but then if you come to the urban areas, you know, there's alienation of land, you know, today going on, you know, but in most of the villages, you know, it is still not possible up to today, you know, for anybody, you know, to alienate land. That's in a nutshell is, you know, what we set out to do in this book, to be able to draw out the critical elements and features of the traditional African society and relate them, you know, to the broad principles and the propositions of anarchism, you know, which basically emphasizes self-managing autonomous communities, you know, that are also self-accounting, you know, to a great extent. The villages, you know, which we had in the traditional African societies, you know, reflected these features, you know, in varying degrees. I've been reading yesterday. I had the opportunity of going through some earlier published works, you know, which I didn't even have the opportunity of, you know, coming across when we were doing this book. And they took a wider sample of different African societies, and in one of them, a book titled Tribes Without Rulers, you know, the authors, who were essentially Western authors, you know, were making the same kind of a comparison. And they talked of these societies being ordered anarchies. That was how they put it, you know. And this represents, you know, the traditional African society, you know, which we sought to evaluate, you know, in this book. There were, of course, a lot of weaknesses in the traditional African society. It's not as if the traditional African societies corresponded in every detail, you know, with the programs of anarchism. The status of women within the traditional African society was, of course, a very low one, in the sense that in most instances, you know, women did not enjoy the same status as men. You know, as could be seen, if you look at the land ownership structure, you know, you would have noticed that all the while when I was talking about both the communal land and the extended family land, you know, I was talking about adult male, you know, having equal claim. You know, it was impossible under the traditional society, you know, for women to really be a part of, you know, the the land owning network, you know, which was established among the adult male. That does not mean that women did not really have land to farm. They had, because whatever land maybe the husband or the father, you know, farmed, the women could also, you know, be a part of it. And as their children grew up, maybe the adult male grew up and they were allocated some land to farm, the mothers could also, you know, farm such land, or their wives, you know. But in a technical sense, you know, women did not own land in the sense that they could not be allotted plots, you know, in their own name, you know, as women, you know, as you know, was done to the adult males. You know, the second obvious weakness of the traditional African society was, of course, that at a point, as these societies developed and grew, you know, potentates started emerging in different parts of Africa. You know, who sought to not only had greater wealth than the rest of the communities, than the rest of the villagers, but also started exploiting labor, you know, in various different ways. You know, the point we just try to make is that, you know, a majority of African states had not actually gotten to the point of feudalism, you know, before the coming of colonialism and the establishment of the state system. To that extent, you know, there was a lot of egalitarianism in the social organizational structure of most parts of Africa. There were, of course, some parts that had actually gotten to the point of feudalism and had already, in fact, established empires, you know, with clear-cut class distinctions, you know, across these societies, you know. It is interesting to note that in the 1970s, late 1970s, you know, there had actually been an attempt, you know, by a government somewhere in Africa, in Tanzania, you know, to incorporate the values of this traditional African society, you know, into the social organization, you know, of farmers and peasants in Tanzania. Under Nyerere, a program of Ujamaa, you know, collectivization of, you know, village groups, you know, was introduced, you know, to bring in, to incorporate elements of this traditional society into the social organization of the people. You know, what he essentially did was to establish, you know, big farms, you know, as communes, and people, the villagers and peasants, you know, farmed, you know, these big farms in common, and government provided the inputs and equipment, you know, for the farming, their farming purposes and needs, and built houses for them in the different farm settlements. You know, this was supposed to recreate, you know, the extended family system of living, you know, which Africa was repeated for, you know. And after about 10 years, you know, close to 2 million people in Tanzania, you know, were taking part in this program. You know, the program was actually modeled on the kibbutz system in Israel, you know, because in Israel you have this collectivization of agriculture, you know. So the Ujamaa system was modeled on the Israeli kibbutz system, you know, but it probably didn't last up to 15 years, you know, before it collapsed. You know, it collapsed, you know, for a whole lot of reasons, one of which was the bureaucracy, you know, that attended the program. Second was the corruption of government officials, you know, which contributed in making this, you know, very creative, you know, idea, you know, to collapse. The third reason was, of course, that the program came at a point, you know, during the Cold War, you know, when the contest between the West and East, you know, was strongest, and this type of alternative, you know, system of economic planning and development, you know, was viewed with hostility, you know, by the West, and you know, they did everything to, you know, sabotage the program. You know, that is as far as you know, one can say about a concrete attempt, you know, on the part of a government, you know, to try and recreate, you know, this traditional system of organizing social organization. There had also been, of course, a couple of regimes that came to power in Africa in this following independence in the 60s and 70s, you know, that paraded themselves as socialist regimes. And, you know, they said they wanted to build, you know, what they called African socialism, you know, on the continent. You know, they used African socialism, you know, to distinguish the kind of Marxist socialism, you know, which, you know, was taking place in Eastern Europe. The whole idea was that you could construct a socialism, you know, with an African face. We had, you know, such experiments in Ghana. We had it in Guinea. We had in Angola. We had in Ethiopia. We had in Zambia to some extent, and even Zimbabwe. But in the final analysis, you know, the whole concept of African socialism, succumbed to the dictatorial tendencies of the state system, you know, besides, you know, the regimes that sought to promote this African socialism, you know, were very repressive and tyrannical. In some cases, even more repressive than the regimes that did not really identify themselves as pursuing a socialism. You know, so the whole concept of African socialism, you know, like the Marxist-Leninist socialist experiment too in Eastern Europe and other parts of Asia and the Caribbean, you know, collapsed. You know, so we in Africa, yeah, most of these regimes today, that previously paraded themselves as a pursuing African socialism, are back, you know, to square one, you know, just like the other capitalist regimes on the African continent, you know. So that represents exactly what we are trying to do in this book. You know, maybe anybody who really wants to, you know, get into details and grasp the details of the analysis, you know, we are trying to put across in this book, could actually, you know, maybe get a copy of the book. I think it's available here. I shall now, you know, try and do a detailed, you know, discourse of the African condition. And in doing this, I would, you know, from time to time, you know, try to make or try to cite concrete examples, you know, with Nigeria and maybe some other African countries. Since I've been here in the United States, I've been really appalled, you know, at the image of Africa, you know, that you get to see or read in the mainstream, you know, mass media in America. It is not as if one does not or did not already know this, you know, but I found it unbelievable that, you know, for weeks on end, you hardly get to read, you know, any concrete, you know, development in Africa, you know, in the mainstream mass media. You know, it is only when there are conflicts and crises, you know, on the continent that you get to read them in the press. And even when you get to read these conflicts and crises, you know, a little background is provided, because, you know, most of the developments in Africa are just seen on the surface, you know, and the impression is created, you know, that every problem on the African continent is all about tribes, ethnic groups, and things like that, you know. But, well, you could say that to a great extent, yes, you know, there's a lot of tribal, ethnic conflicts on the African continent. You know, but if you want to understand and evaluate, you know, the complexities and dynamics of these crises and conflicts, you know, you must certainly have to go beyond the appearances of tribes and ethnic groups in understanding and appreciating, you know, the crises and difficulties we have on the African continent. No sooner had the slave trade ended, you know, than the Berlin Conference of 1884-1885, you know, took place. At that conference, several European powers, you know, just sat down somewhere in Europe and merely looking at the map of Africa, decided to partition up Africa, you know, among themselves. In the process of doing this, you know, they lumped several disparate groups, you know, into nation states of their desires, and forcefully, you know, pushed them into these nation states, and these nation states started existing. To a great extent, the exercise of that took place in Berlin in 1884, 1885, you know, was arbitrary. It was arbitrary because people of different social, historical, and cultural background, you know, were whimsically lumped, you know, together into different geographical territories as nation states. Over time, you know, we've seen that this exercise was not only arbitrary; it has proved to be artificial. Artificial in the sense that here you had Africa, you know, you brought, in some cases like Nigeria, you know, you brought a section of the African continent that had actually gotten to the point of feudalism and lumped it together with several village groups, you know, that, you know, we are still at the level of a village social organization, and welded them into a country. And it is the same thing for virtually every part of Africa. So far, you know, since this very exercise in 1884, 1885, the colonial states, you know, sought, you know, to preserve these boundaries, you know, through the instrumentality of force. You know, that is how, you know, the nation states on the African continent have been preserved. Even after the colonialists left and political independence was granted, you know, it is still force, you know, that has been used, you know, by the neo-colonial political elite that emerged after the colonialists left. It is still force that they have been using, you know, to sustain these geographical boundaries created by the colonialists. So if you really want to, you know, begin to understand Africa's problems, then you must put the partitioning and the balkanization of African continent in 1884-85 in a within perspective, because a lot of the problems that today beset the African continent, you know, the seeds and the foundation, you know, were laid, you know, at the point of that exercise. Then, of course, I just want to use, I just want to address, you know, in passing, the phenomenon of tribes and ethnic groups in Africa. The Western colonialists, you know, tried to give the impression that tribes and ethnic groups had always existed on the African continent, and that they actually met tribes and ethnic groups, you know, at the point of colonialism and introduction of capitalism. You know, but unfortunately, this is not exactly the case. It is not exactly the case, because apart from those African societies, you know, that had gotten to the point of feudalism, you know, the tribe, what we know today as tribes and ethnic groups, had not actually developed, you know, prior to the coming of colonialism and the establishment of the state system in Africa.